Hey everyone, welcome to the Front Stretch Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Albina. Now this week, I'm joined as always by my colleague, Mike Neff, to discuss a good race weekend at Bristol Motor Speedway, where Kyle Busch picked up his third victory of the season. Then, Harrison Burton calls in to reflect on his Xfinity Series debut, where he started fifth, overcame some adversity late in the going to get a top 10 finish, and he goes in-depth on what it's like driving for Kyle Busch in the Truck Series and where the Truck team is currently at. But as always, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the Front Stretch Podcast on iTunes. Those ratings help us out tremendously. Now let's throw it to my conversation with Neff. All right, Neff, pretty good race this weekend at Bristol. We had Kyle Busch spin on lap two, only to come back to win later in the race. Overall, Neff, what are your thoughts on the race? Because I thought it was a pretty good one.
I thought it was fantastic. I mean, I've been a fan of quote-unquote New Bristol since they did it. I love, excuse me, that you've got two lanes, at least two lanes, if not three lanes, of legitimate racing option at a half-mile track. And the fact that you get guys running side by side, it reminds me so much of old Richmond, where a guy would get on the inside and a guy would be on the outside, and it would literally take 15 or 20 laps to make a pass, because a guy would gain an inch, and lose it, and he would just kind of go back and forth. You have the same thing up there. You're at the bottom. You gain going in the corner, but the momentum takes you on the high side coming out of the corner, and it gives the drivers options. You have lap traffic coming into play, so how you get through that affects how you run. I mean, I don't know what else you want out of a race if you're a race fan. If you're a fan that wants to see cars crashing, then I understand your displeasure with it. But as far as a race fan and wanting to see true hardcore racing, I think it's the best that we've seen all season.
Yeah, and like I mentioned last week on the podcast, I've only been to Bristol and covered a race once, which was last August, and I truly believe, you know, that's the most badass place I've been out of all the tracks, including Daytona, you know, all the top tracks. It's just so fun to watch a race. You can see everything from the press box, from the stands. And this race was no different. You said a lot of passing. There's a lot of racing for the lead, too. We had a battle, you know, between Ryan Blaney and Joey Logano. Epic battle for the lead. And they had Clint Bowyer come from, like, a second or two back to catch him. And then Keselowski was catching them. And I think Kyle Busch was even catching them. So it almost had a five-car race for the lead. But then, like you said, you know, you have to work on a driver, running that outside line. You know, you get a run on the inside line, but you can only get so far up because then the outside line, being Blaney, would get a huge run off the corner, just like any track. So, very good race. Neff, Kyle Busch, though, third win in 8 races this year. Still hasn't finished outside the top 10 in any National Series start so far. Is this the year of Kyle Busch? Is this going to continue?
You never know. I mean, the way this sport goes is it can be cyclical, and guys get hot and guys get cold, and organizations figure things out. But we've seen for the last few years that Toyota puts more effort, I think, from a manufacturer standpoint, into the sport than the other two manufacturers. And I think that has really shown out even the last few years. Even though Ford ended up being so dominant last year, I still feel like Toyota is the manufacturer that really puts the effort out. And we've talked about this a week or two ago when the whole 200 win thing came about, that Kyle truly is right now, if you look at it, historical models, he is coming into his prime right now. I mean, 32, 33 to like 38 or 39 is a driver's prime time. So he's just at the front end of that. So I feel like it may not only be the year of Kyle, this may be coming into the decade of Kyle. We may really see him just dominate from now until late in the 2020s, because he's at that point in his career where he should. I mean, with his talent, he is at that point where he should be the apex driver in this sport. Joey Logano is going to be right there with him and keep him honest. Brad Keselowski is going to be there for a bit too. But at this point, I feel like he is the number one driver in this sport. And if history proves out, we should see several years here of a whole bunch of wins and several championships.
Yeah, I mean, when you said after the, you know, during the 200 win podcast that he'd win 100 cup wins, I was kind of like, eh. And now he's gotten two more since then. And I know it's, you know, it's only two more, but, you know, everyone counts, obviously. So, I mean, he's on pace right now to win about 12, 13 races this year. It honestly, I'm serious, it would not surprise me. It really wouldn't. Yeah, obviously, the sport's cyclical, like you said, but he's just good everywhere. And, like, I mean, I don't know. He's got 8 top 10s. He's the first driver to do that to start off the season since 1992 when Terry Labonte did it. 27 years it hasn't been done. So it seems like, you know, he's kind of toying with him at Bristol the past couple years or the past couple races. This, you know, both on lap 2 crashes, spinning out both times. Did go a lap down this time, I believe. And then went 2 laps down last time. So, I mean, whenever you go to Bristol, the Busch brothers are going to do good. We both picked them last week on the podcast, and they finished 1-2. So no big surprise. Now, I don't know if I was surprised or maybe happy to hear this on the radio that Kurt Busch said he would wreck Kyle for the win.
Oh yeah,
that was just you want to hear that.
I am so with you. I'm sitting here. I was like you. I was listening on the radio. I was coming back from Charlotte. Listening to the race on the radio, and they had that interview after the race, and I'm like, God, I wish I could have seen that play out. I mean, because I've been around long enough to remember the All-Star race when Kyle went and took both of them out, and that made Thanksgiving pretty rough at the Busch household for a couple of years, until their mom literally sat him down and said, you two are brothers, and blood is thicker than water, you need to work this out. But I think that Kyle is a little more mature now and probably would have handled it a little better knowing that he's already got multiple wins and he's locked in the championship, but he'd still been fuming. And it could have been really cool to watch brothers like throw down in victory lane, like Kyle come in there and freaking take a swing at Kurt. Cause it would have been, I would have loved to have seen that. And Kurt made no bones. It wasn't like he's like, I was going to move him. He said, I was going to go into 3 and drive straight through him to get the win. I mean, there was no move him involved. He was going to flat out wreck him to get to it. And that would have been the most unbelievable thing to see. But unfortunately, he got a little out of shape, bounced it off the wall with like 2 laps to go, and he never got back to it.
Yeah, no diss at Kyle, but it would have been cool to see. I mean, 2 brothers going at it, literally for the win. It was the second time that they finished 1-2 in their career, the other time being Kyle's first win back from his injury in 2015 at Sonoma. That would have been insane to see. I mean, just being honest. But Kurt, he came from 27th, finished 2nd. It's his 3rd top 5 this year, Neff. Last year, the number 1 car only had 2. So, we're 8 races in, and I mean, obviously, there's been an uptick in performance with him. Maybe not with Chip Ganassi Racing as a whole, because Kyle Larson's off a bit. But Kurt's, I would say he's still the top Chevy driver right now.
It seems that way. I mean, you got to give a shout-out to Chase Elliott.
Yeah.
He was obviously fast, and I think without the power steering issue, he may have been an even greater factor, but he was still a factor for much of the day. But from a consistency throughout the year standpoint, yeah, Kurt is the top dog right now. And, I mean, we talked about it coming into the season, and we really thought it was not going to only showcase his abilities still a little bit, but it was going to really bring out what a good crew chief Matt McCall is. I mean, I'm biased because I've known Matt for a long time from the short track days down here in the Southeast, and I just consider him a really bright mind in the sport. But I always felt like he had the knowledge and the ability to make cars go fast, and they just weren't getting it. And now they're at that point where they're making a good strategy calls and getting some speed. I feel like they got a little bit more to go on the speed side of things, but yeah, I'm with you. I think Kurt's going to do his typical win 1 or 2 races this year before the playoffs. And then I've said it since the playoffs started, although it's been mixed up some now, but back in 2004, the final 10 races of the season were like 8 of the 10 best tracks for Kurt Busch.
Mm-hmm.
And so the playoffs have always lined up well for Kurt if he was in good equipment. And he had a shot last year for sure. And I think I'm with you right now. We very well could see a Bush and Bush battle to the championship all the way to the head this year.
Yeah, I mean, I believe last year, I know we both had Kyle in the Final Four, but I believe we both had Kurt in the Final Four as well prior to the post, you know, the playoffs beginning. But one thing they got to fix up is qualifying. Six straight starts outside the top 15, Neff. That's unlike Kurt Busch, who usually wins two, three, maybe. Last year, I think he had a career record in polls.
Yeah. I mean, the qualifying has been kind of a bugaboo all year long. You know, NASCAR's still figuring out qualifying, too, and I think we're probably going to see us go back to single-car qualifying on the bigger tracks. But it's... In the modern era where track position is so important, it is a factor. But I think when you got Kurt behind the wheel, it's not as big of a factor as it could be for somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just sets him behind from the beginning. Like, you think about, he coming from 27th to 2nd. A couple weeks ago, I think he started 30th in a race. I mean, he starts that far behind at the beginning. Just imagine if he started even half that, 15th. So
right, and it also impacts him on pit stall selection.
Oh, for sure, yeah, definitely. But I think... You know, we'll continue to see Kurt doing well. He's won at Richmond a couple times, dominated at Richmond a couple times, and that's obviously where we're going this weekend. Neff, I want to talk about Team Penske a little bit. We talk about them, seems like, every week because I still think they're the best team overall. Yeah, they seem like they're still the best team in the garage overall. But I think they kind of let this one slip away as an organization because you look at, you know, there's a caution for Kyle to get the lead. He stayed out in a late race caution, him and Kurt both, as did Paul Menard and a few others. And then you had Logano and Keselowski, what, running 1-2 in Hamlin, or Blaney was 4th, I believe. And they restarted like 6th, 8th, and then we'll talk about Brad later. But Logano got to 3rd, Blaney 4th. They led combined over 300 laps. So I would say probably disappointing to let this one get away.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they let it get away, and there's some disappointment there. But I felt like it was the right call. I know letting Kyle have clean track with under 20 to go is iffy, but Brad's monkeying around on the restart there cost him a couple laps, although at the end of the race, Kyle was far enough ahead that I don't know a couple laps would have made a difference. They probably needed another caution, but at the same time, you kind of expected a caution, though, as crazy as it gets around the front on the restarts at Bristol when you're going for the win. So I didn't think that was necessarily a bad thing. I mean, Joey passed 4 cars by the exit of turn 2 on the restart at the end of the race. So he was coming. It was just he got held up a little bit getting through that. But I thought it was a decent call because of the fact that you had 20-something laps to go. But at the same time, the tire fall off might not have been as much as we had expected there. So I don't know. I think it forced his hand. I think if he stayed out, everybody behind him would have come. So you're damned if you do, damned if you don't there. But I thought they made the right call. At the same time, as you said, it did let it slip away. But, man, Blaney was fast all day. Logano had probably the best car all day. And it's Bristol. You never know what's going to happen until they wave the checkered flag.
Yeah, I think you said it perfectly when you said you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. Because we saw this also at the end of stage one. When Ty Dillon got the stage win, he passed Clint Bowyer on, well, didn't really pass him. It was a photo finish at the line. But tires just, I mean, I guess they seemed to matter over a long run. But there's only, 14 laps or so when they went green?
Yep.
I don't know. Obviously, as a leader, you're in a tough spot. You always are. Doesn't matter the track, unless it's like Atlanta or Fontana where tire fall-offs way too drastic that you have to pit. Bristol's a little bit different, though. And this week, obviously, they're running the fastest they've ever ran at Bristol. Had a couple track records set. So, I don't know. I wouldn't want to be in Todd Gordon's position or Jeremy Bullen's position because you're kind of screwed whatever way you do go, but it turned out to be the wrong decision. But overall, Neff, I mean, they're fast every week, all three of them, and it doesn't look like it's going to stop. I would still say they're the best team in NASCAR.
For right now, yeah. As you mentioned, I feel like the Chevys are gaining. They're picking up some more speed. Hendrick seemed to do a little bit better again this weekend, so they're clawing back at it a little bit. But I'm with you, too, that I'm really kind of befuddled on Larson. Larson seems to be out to lunch quite a bit this year. I don't know what's going on with the 42 car. But week in and week out, yeah, Penske is the gold standard by far, and everybody else is trying to catch him outside of – well, I mean, look at the results so far this year. We've had all Joe Gibbs or Penske wins, a little bit more on the Gibbs side, but it comes down to those two teams right now, and everybody else is just a squirrel trying to find a nut. So we'll continue to see. As I said, I think somewhere around Charlotte, right before or right after Charlotte, is when we will probably see the Chevys finally get to the point where they're on a pretty level playing field. And then we'll really start to find out who's going to be the title contenders. Although I'm with you, I think it's the Busch brothers and whoever else works in there from Penske.
Yeah, and you could even throw Denny Hamlin in there, because it's hard to gauge Joe Gibbs Racing as a whole right now, because you got Busch and you got Hamlin winning races, and then you got the other two are pretty inconsistent, which is unlike Truex, but you know, the past couple of years. But we talked about that last week on the podcast. Mm-hmm. About how, you know, coming over to a new shop, new location, new everything, there's going to be some change and you know, some uncertainty, but they're going to be fast. I'm sure they'll work on it, obviously, and they'll just keep getting better throughout the season. Erik Jones is kind of a surprise, too, though, because he had a couple loose wheels on Sunday and finished 24th at one of his best tracks. I mean, remember the Bristol 2017 night race? He led, like, what, 200-something laps and finished second to Kyle, so I don't know. It's definitely something we're going to have to watch going forward. But overall, I mean, yes, Gibbs has 5 wins. Penske has 3. But I would put Penske over Gibbs as a whole, if that makes sense.
I understand. Yeah, I probably agree with you on that. One thing I did want to throw out here real quick. I talked to several crew members in Martinsville. And I'm like, you know, the talk on the pit guns has kind of died down. Are they better? Have they worked on stuff out on it? And every one of them was like, nope, they're garbage. They're still garbage. It's a crapshoot as to what you get. And they've given up complaining about it because there's nothing they're going to do. But it honestly seems to me, especially this weekend, but even over the last 3 or 4 races, that there have been more and more loose wheels than even last year.
Yeah, a ton.
And I want to say it was the truck race in Texas that one of the crew members actually had a gun like break in half, that they were in the pit stop and the handle just snapped off the gun. So I know we're not hearing as much about it, but that is still kind of a big deal on pit lane. And I think it is still having impacts on races. And we saw it again this weekend. Like you said, we named off talking about it before the show, 7 or 8 guys that had loose wheels. And I feel like something needs to be looked at in that realm again. I don't know how long the Paoli contract is, but they should have their feet held to the fire a little bit more, because it's not living up to a standard that I think a NASCAR Cup Series air gun should have to live up to.
Right. We really shouldn't. In a professional sport, we shouldn't have to worry about the equipment breaking.
Exactly.
So I think it was last week at Texas. I think it was William Byron. I might be wrong on that, but his also, you know, the pit gun snapped in half, and then the crew member actually ran over the wall and got the other one and finished the stop in, you know, a respectable time for all that happening, all that chaos. So they obviously, yeah, they must practice stuff like that too. And you know, in weird instances where, you know, it probably won't ever come up, maybe 1 in 1,000 chance, but it does, and they're prepared. So kudos to them. Neff, you brought up Kyle Larson. Now, I want to talk a little bit about Ryan Blaney, but it'll transition to Kyle Larson. Another 158 laps led for Blaney. Another Bristol win, he let slip away. I think that's 3 straight races where he's led over 100 laps at the track. We talked about this last week, him finishing the deal, but it seems to be kind of the young guns as a whole not finishing the deal. Chase Elliott obviously got those 3 wins last year in the final, 15 races, but it just kind of seems, and I was hearing Jeff Gluck talk on his podcast about this after the race, it just kind of seems like, not that they haven't, I don't know, you could say they haven't performed up to expectations, because Kyle, Logano, Keselowski, I mean, we're all getting the same winners, it seems like, that we were 2-3 years ago. Harvick?
Yeah, I mean, it's... It takes a whole package to win a cup race. It's one thing to be fast. It's one thing to race well. It's something different to win. And it's different at the cup level because the races are longer. Things develop over time. And depending on the different drivers have different styles or different ways that they communicate with their team and how they want their car to be. And some are more adaptable as a car fluctuates than others. We've talked about again this year that the adjustable track bar going away. And that's something that these younger guys honestly haven't dealt with at the cup level. Because we've had that adjustable track bar for several years. So these guys have come in and they're now having to relearn how to handle the car as it transitions through a tire run because you're not able to adjust how the car handles. And it's something that they used to be able to do where these older guys lived with that before. So there's multiple factors that all have to line up to win a race. And these guys are slowly learning how to piece them all together. And eventually, once you do, you tend to see that start taking off and manifesting into multiple wins. Larson's been a little of a question mark with that because, you know, he got that first win and you expected him to start kind of racking up, and it still hasn't. You know, he gets that occasional win, but he hasn't gone on a run of a few or a bunch yet. I feel like that day is still coming, and we're going to see one of these years where Larson has 8 or 9 wins and makes a real run at a title. But Byron and Elliott and those guys, it takes a while to learn how to win races. And once you do, then you start doing it more often. And at this point, they just haven't figured out all of the building blocks in the order that they all stack up to win these races.
Yeah, I mean, you forget that Larson's only, 25 or 26 years old because he's been in the sport for a while now.
Yeah.
But him, Elliott, Blaney, Suarez, Jones, Byron, these are all – Chris Buescher, they're all talented drivers. And they've just got to figure out how to put a whole race together, like you said, and win. And yes, it's a lot different from other series. But there's, I don't know. It's just, it's got to be frustrating for them, I would imagine, because they're so good. A lot of them are really good equipment. And like Blaney, he leads 158 laps. I mean, he's been feast or famine this year. He's got 4 top fives and then 4 finishes of 22nd or worse. I don't know. A win's bound to happen. It's not like they're going to luck into one. They're going to get one. But he's got, 300, I'm looking it up now, 353 laps left for the year. That's by far the most of anyone without a win. The next is Larson at 142, and he did that all at Atlanta. He led all 142 laps at Atlanta. So outside of Atlanta, and he finished 12th there because he had a pit road speeding penalty late. I mean, it's been kind of a disaster of a year for him, and he even put a gif up on Twitter on Sunday. It was kind of like my Sundays every week or something, and there's a gif, and I don't know, you'd have to see it to understand it, but it seems like he's kind of dreading the races now. So it's just really, really interesting this year so far, and I don't know, because like we think of Kyle Larson, right? They finished second in both races last year to Kyle and then to Kurt. And they were a non-factor from the get-go. And yes, they had a loose wheel early, which we talked about. A lot of loose wheels this weekend. But then they got in 2 crashes late. So, you know, they still got 19th finish out of all that. But, man, I don't know. He's always runs well at Bristol. And it's just like, I mean, you have Kurt in second and then him in 19th. So, I don't know. I'm kind of at a loss for words.
Yeah, and I kind of wonder, he doesn't ever strike me as a driver that lets other people around him affect how he races or how he runs. But I gotta wonder if there's a little bit of pressure coming in because of the fact that Kurt is doing so well and he's not. If he's actually feeling a little added pressure to perform because Kurt has come in as a new guy to that team and is outrunning him. So I gotta think that as much as you want to turn a blind eye and put the blinders on and focus on your deal, he's got to hear the talk and know that, hey, people are talking about Kurt coming in and doing this and outrunning me. I better get up on the wheel. So And yeah, there's pressure there. It's a matter of how much he's letting that get to him as well. And there's just bad luck.
Yeah.
I mean,
he's got a lot of that.
Daniel Hemrick put out a tweet.
Oh, God. I saw that.
That said, anybody wants to send any kind of good luck charms and put the address for RCR in there. Because it's true, man. Those guys have been bitten so many times by other people's messes. It's ridiculous. It's just bad luck. So, yeah, we'll see if their luck turns around, too. But the cream always rises.
Sure.
And I understand it. I mean, we've seen it with Jimmy Johnson, too. He's having a bad stretch, but I still feel like he's got one more run in him before his career comes to an end.
Yeah, I agree on all that. But in comparison to Kurt and Larson, Kurt's got an average finishing this year of 8.6, when Larson's 15.6. So, on average, 7 positions better per race. And, I mean, yeah, average like he's...
races.
Yeah, so... I don't know. We'll have to. This will definitely be something to keep our eye on going forward. Only because Kurt's the new guy at Chip Ganassi Racing, and he's outperforming Larson by quite a bit so far to start the season. Now, I think it's worth talking about the runs for like this weekend for Ryan Newman. He got his first top 10 with Roush Fender Racing, and really the past, you know, we don't talk a lot about Newman on this podcast because really since we started there hasn't been much to talk about. No diss to him, just fact. So. Finished 9th, ran in the top 10 all day, ran in the top 10 all day last week too at Texas, finished 11th. I feel like he's kind of elevated Roush a little bit since he's got there, and the finishes are starting to come around.
Yeah, it seems that way. Kind of feel like they're getting on the same page and getting things headed in the right direction. Bristol's always been a good track for Roush. I mean, if you look at Ricky Stenhouse's career, like 80% of his best finishes have been at Bristol. I mean, that's always where I thought he was going to get his first win. I never thought it was going to be on plate tracks, but that was just the way it worked out. But, you know, Newman and Stenhouse are both dirt guys that have run open wheel midgets and stuff like that, that Bristol suits them. Well, now the Texas was a different story for Newman. That, I thought, was a really strong statement for Roush because they've been out to lunch for years on intermediate tracks. And to be able to have that kind of finish there was a big deal. So, yeah, we'll see. I know that they brought Kenseth in last year, and Kenseth kind of got them steered in a better direction than they were. And now Newman has picked up that baton and is continuing to run with it. We'll, you know, I don't know that we'll see him get a win. We might, but it is interesting. I didn't expect him to do as well as he has so far, so I'm pleasantly surprised. Always got to pull a little bit for my Purdue guy, but he's surprised a little bit. We'll see how it goes down the road.
Yeah, he told me last year at Indy, no matter how bad things have gotten, whether they were at RCR, Penske, now Roush, obviously didn't tell me at Roush at the time because it wasn't announced then, but, you know, he's never lacked confidence. And so that's obviously, you know, it's a mental game too. And if you're not running well, it could be easy to get down in confidence and you don't have all this momentum. But, I mean, he finished 3rd in stage 2. I didn't even realize that until I just saw it. So I thought it was like 5th or 6th. And so I mean, it's been so long since we've seen the six car run well. I honestly can't. Maybe David Reagan was in it in like 2011. Maybe that was the last time it ran well. You had Kenseth win stage 1 at Indy last year, but I mean, they had terrible luck. And then Trevor Bain was just average. And then they had the whole dilemma with him and Kenseth last year. So it's been a long time since we've seen the six car really be this competitive, I would say. But other strong runs this week were for. We were talking off air about Chris Buescher because he was in the top 10 for pretty much whole day. And then unfortunately, yeah. A late race cut tire. So it, you know, forced him to finish 22nd, unfortunately. But really strong run for him. And then also Matt DiBenedetto. He finished 12th, but was en route to a 6th place finish before that last caution. So I know he was pissed off on Twitter. He had this video and it was kind of down because he just felt like Levine Family Racing deserved to finish better. Probably did deserve to finish better. So, what are your thoughts on those Tuesdays?
I mean, Buescher and JTG in general, they're close to Hemrick level. They just seem to constantly be getting in somebody else's mess that impacts their finishes. And I think Friesen and Buescher both are having some strong runs, and I feel like that organization is getting better and almost crossing over the divide to be at the back end of the high-end teams rather than the front end of the low-end teams. And that I don't think it's going to be long before that unofficial transition happens. But, yeah, Buescher had a great run all day long, was literally right there at the top 10. I want to say at one point he was fourth or fifth, not during, like, a pit stop sequence. It was a matter of he drove up to fourth or fifth. But like you said, he caught the bad luck with a cut tire late that cost him. And DiBenedetto, I love that they seem to be fully taking advantage of the opportunity that has been presented to them by being a partner with Gibbs. And they are, you know, it's one thing to get your equipment from the big dog. It's another thing to run with the big dogs. And they not only are getting the equipment, but it seems like they are taking full advantage of the whole partnership and utilizing that to run well. We've always, I don't say we, most everybody's known that Matty D is one of the better drivers out there if he got in some good equipment. And now he's in some good equipment. And the 95 winning a race, I think, is still a huge stretch. But the 95 knocking off a whole bunch of top 10s by the end of the year, I don't think is. And I think that that's where they are right now. And it's just a matter of, you know, similar to those young guys putting together the wins, Matty D's been a long time scratching and clawing to maybe get one top 10 a year. And now he's learning how to run and get consistent top 10 finishes.
Yeah, and we talked about this a little bit when Ross Chastain took over the 42 last year in Xfinity for Chip Ganassi Racing. It's so different when you run in not backmarker equipment, but equipment that doesn't have the funding that, you know, the Chip Ganassi Racing does. And granted, you know, comparing that to Levine Family Racing is a little different. But, I mean, even just the acceleration and the restarts, you got to learn pretty much everything all over again because the equipment's different. So, I mean, I think DiBenedetto, he had a hell of a Daytona 500. Came off the bat strong. And then it's just kind of been average since, but you expect that. You expect growing pains with a new team and in a new company a company that's with a new alliance with Joe Gibbs Racing. So I think that'll continue to grow as the season, you know, goes on. And DiBenedetto, like you said, everyone knows he's a good driver. I know Kyle Larson touted him over huge in an interview last year with Jeff Gluck, saying he thinks he's the most underrated driver in all of NASCAR. So, but to be honest with you, like, I believe he's underrated too, very underrated, but I believe Buescher's underrated too. I say this all the time, but he won the 2015 Xfinity Championship with Roush, where his teammates, you know, were like 9th and 12th in the points or something. Like, he outran Chase Elliott. I forget, Suarez was in the series at the time. There's so many good guys, Ty Dillon. There's so many good guys in the series and better equipment, and he was just consistent. So I'm a fan of Buescher's when it comes to, you know, hard-nosed racer. Like you said, they have a little bit of bad luck, but if that gets straightened around, man, I don't know. I could see them, you know, scratching off a bunch of top 10s too.
Yep, yeah, and Trent Owens is one of my Tech Talk guys. Love him to death. He's been around his sport a long time. And he's just one of those savvy racer guys that will figure out ways to get an extra position or two, will make some strategy calls to put him out front. And in the end, it's going to come together at some point in time.
All right, I got two more topics I want to talk about enough. And one of them is kind of, I don't have the words to really describe how I feel about it, but Brad Keselowski, late in the going, NASCAR told him, I saw on Twitter, I read five or six times they were saying, get in line, and he didn't get in the right position on the late race restart, so he came into the pits fourth and exited like 18th, and he had to come in and make a penalty under the green, yeah, pass through under the green, so he finished the lap down in 18th. He was really outspoken to reporters after the race, saying, you know, there's too many penalties, too many wave rounds, too many free passes, you know, kind of criticizing NASCAR. comes out yesterday. He said NASCAR made the right call. So, I mean, I think they probably did make the right call. Obviously, if he thinks so, he probably got a call, as we talked about off air. But, I mean, if they're telling you, I mean, that restart looked like a shit show. They're like four wide coming to the green. So, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think there was some strategy going on there. I think it was a deal that Keselowski had taken two tires and was hoping that there were going to be a few more guys take two that would be between him and the four-tire guys. And then it turned out there weren't. So he was right in front of the four-tire guys, and he knew that his only real chance at staying where he was or getting anywhere further forward, by very much anyway, was going to be a short run. And the more laps that they could get him to burn up under caution, the shorter the run was going to be. So I think he was doing his best to monkey around and get them to burn a few more laps under caution. And in NASCAR's credit, they got tired of it.
Right.
And they basically said, hey, we've told you enough. We're going green. They dropped the rag with them all over the track. And then they threw the black flag on Keselowski. And, you know, yes, do I think there's too many rules? Absolutely. Do I think there's too many wave-arounds and lucky dogs and all that? I completely agree with them. But at the same time, it's a sport in which we live. And in the efforts of safety, we kind of have to have that stuff. So you got to deal with it. But bottom line, I think they were trying to make a strategic play there that ended up biting them. And that's why he ended up where he was. But I think if they had five or six other cars take two, that he wouldn't have tried to do that because he'd had a little buffer between him and the four-tire guys.
I was kind of surprised by the whole deal, I got to be honest, because NASCAR almost never lets a race go back to green when they're three or four wide like that, especially at Bristol.
Well, and especially not that far up in the field.
Right.
I mean, I've seen plenty of restarts where,
oh, for sure,
you know, 28 through 35th or seven wide coming out of four, they don't care because they're all that far back. But to be that far up in the field and have it that jumbled up is really rare.
Correct. Yeah, so that was surprising. I agree with you on Keselowski's comment about how there's too many rules, too many free passes, too many wave runs, whatever. But I don't know. I guess it takes someone to be outspoken, and then I don't know. I mean, Keselowski's always been outspoken. We've talked about that. I think it was last week, maybe 2 weeks ago. But he's very calculative in how he does it. So maybe this will lead to something. Who knows? But it's kind of weird, just the whole thing. But that was one of the things I want to talk about, Neff. The other thing, I got two more things, actually. One of them you'll go pretty in-depth on, I think. But one of them is the attendance, man. It sucked. I saw that I read that there's like 38,000 to 40,000 people, and I think that's being kind. They kind of set it up like a stadium. I mean, obviously it looks like a stadium, but they set it up where you would sit, if it was a football stadium, on the sidelines, so on the front stretch and back stretch. And then the corners were empty, like completely empty.
They didn't have those open.
It looked terrible. And like, so I went to WrestleMania on Sunday, so I didn't watch the race live, so I was tweeting about it yesterday. And it was a really entertaining race, especially the first stage. But when I saw that crowd, man, I was like, holy crap, what is going on? And obviously the sport's been on a decline a little bit. We talked about that. We know that. But this is bad because you look 10, 15 years ago, those stands were sold out. And sure, you know, Bristol's in the April, when it's been in March and April for years now, it's been hit by snow, rain, four out of the past 5 years or something like that. So it's not in a good spot in the schedule, but I don't know. That's just really, it's kind of embarrassing.
There are so many different things at play in this deal. the spring race has always been less attended than the night race.
Yes, by far.
Even when they said there were sellouts, you would see holes and have, you know, 10 or 15,000 empty seats easily. And maybe even more than that over the last few years. Just because it's the spring race. And as you mentioned, the weather's usually crappy. And you're dealing with the Bristol economy, where you have a less than ideal number of hotel rooms.
Yep.
And the hotels know that, so they jack up their prices, every market that we go into does the same thing. It's not unique to Bristol, Bristol may jack it up a little more than some of the others because their supply is a little less. But I in reality, I don't know that that matters that much. The fact that it's a 3-4 hour drive from Charlotte, it should not be hard to fill that place up with people that could drive up and back for a day. You're not that far from Roanoke, Virginia. You're not that far from Knoxville. Hell, you're not that far from Cincinnati when you're right down to it, that people could drive in a day and not have to worry about hotels. And I've been outspoken about it for a while, that I honestly think every track should have one race date. And I've said it all along, that spring race at Bristol should go away and go to another short track. So, I mean, there's a ton of factors at play, but even that said, with all of those factors at play, I was shocked as well at how sparse that crowd was. I was really, you know, I expected there to be maybe half full, but man, it was less than that. And it comes at a really crappy time, too, because we're in the middle of this push of everybody screaming and hollering they want more short tracks. And then you have a short track race, and it looks like an Xfinity crowd shows up. And you're like, do we really want more short tracks? Obviously, nobody showed up when we had one at arguably the best short track that we offer. And you hear all these people talking about how, well, they've ruined the racing and it's not what we, you know, what we used to spend the money for. So the bottom line is, based on attendance and history and fan voice, we need to start going back to a model where every 15 to 25 laps, two cars just destroy each other. And we tear the crap out of stuff and we wreck a bunch and we end up costing team owners hundreds of thousands of dollars and guys are throwing helmets and getting in fistfights. Because that's the history of the sport and the history of ticket sales, that is what they want. And whether it's, you know, Tony Stewart throwing his helmet at Kenseth or Ward Burton throwing his booties at Dale Jr., you know, Jeff Gordon trying to beat the crap out of Keselowski in Texas or Kenseth tackling Keselowski in Charlotte, that's what the fans want. I mean, based on ratings and ticket sales and everything else, that is what the fans want. So we are going to have to, again, it's an entertainment business. We're going to have to sit down with the drivers and say, look, if anybody goes 10 laps without running into another car, you're going to get black flagged.
Well,
it sounds idiotic, and in all honesty, it is idiotic, but based on what the fans have said in social media, in ticket sales, in telephone call-ins, whatever, that is what they want to see.
Yeah, I mean, I do know that, you know, Steve Phelps was on the Dale Jr. download last week, and after listening to it, I do know that they're going to be talking to a lot of the drivers. The driver council's kind of gone away now. They kind of do it in groups. They meet with drivers in groups now, and they're going to do that. They're supposed to be doing it this weekend in Richmond, so, you know, it's probably a good weekend to do it because of what happened, you know, the crowd at Bristol. I don't know. I feel like you said a lot of what I want to say, but I, you know, you look at like a tweet from Clint Bowyer on Saturday after he broadcasted the Xfinity race, and he tweeted, had some curiosity after I came back from the race today, made some calls, this is what I got. The Johnson City Courtyard, so a hotel, was 319 per night, but now are taking walk-ins at 105. The Hampton Inn in, I'm guessing Johnson City, was 308 per night, but will be down to 133 on Monday. And then he said reason he gave was it's race weekend. And then he said it pisses him off. Yes, it pisses everyone off. It pisses fans off. It pisses media off. I know Matt Weaver tweeted out that he slept in his truck on Thursday in Bristol. I've slept in my car before. I mean, and I'm sure you've slept in your truck. I mean, it sucks that it's come down to this, but it's really frustrating. It's really frustrating.
It's the history of the sport.
Oh, though. For sure.
I mean, in all honesty, 300's a deal. If you go back to when Bristol was sold out on a regular basis, it was 500 or 600 a night with a 5-night minimum. Now there's no night minimums. You know, you're just paying 300. it used to be almost twice that much, and you had to book it for almost a week. So, I mean, yes, it's still jacked up prices, but it's not jacked up like it used to be.
Okay, and I get your point for sure, but then, like I said, I went to WrestleMania this week, right? Didn't stay at a hotel or anything. WrestleMania's a pretty big deal. People come in from all over the world, you know, many different countries, different continents, to come see the show. And I didn't stay at a hotel, but I got a shuttle from a hotel, and I asked the driver, how much are they charging for this, for, like, rooms here? And he said, $119. That's reasonable. And it was only 3 miles away from MetLife Stadium in New Jersey, which is where the show was. So, I don't know. I mean, yes, they're going to, you know.
Okay, but where's MetLife Stadium?
It's in East Rutherford, New Jersey. And there's
right, how close are you to
it's right New over York City? The, right over the bay. So
how many hotel rooms are within 30 miles of there?
Yeah, you definitely got a point.
Hundreds of thousands. That's the deal, is at most of your NASCAR tracks are not in a major metropolitan area.
You're right.
And so, you know, unlike Indy, you know, Indy has got a huge amount of hotel rooms because they've hosted Super Bowls, they've hosted major events. So you have the supply there. But you go to, you know, Richmond, Virginia, it's just not a sprawling metropolis like, you know, like even Indianapolis. You go to Chicago. Yes, Joliet's maybe a 45-minute drive away, but you can stay. There's plenty of hotel rooms that you can find. When you go to most of your NASCAR tracks, you're out away from these bigger cities.
Yeah, you're in the country, pretty much. Yeah.
But hell, you go to Charlotte. Try and call up the Embassy Suites right there on Bruton Smith, you know, a mile from the track for race weekend, and find out how much room is. I promise you, it's $400 or $500 on race weekend.
And same could be said for Daytona, like for the 500. I'm sure for the July race too. I know, I think it was last year, might have been 2017, Adam Stern tweeted out, you know, like average price within a certain distance. He got all these stats from, you know, for Daytona, and it was over $500. It was like $150 more than the Super Bowl. So, you know, our Super Bowl, it just, I don't know, I'm speaking out of term here maybe, but it just, it's hard to digest, honestly. Yes, it's the history of the sport.
It's frustrating, and at the same time, you talk to people in Bristol, and for these hotels, they make 80 or 90% of their annual income off of the two race weekends. Because nothing else goes on there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you get the drag racing, but that doesn't pull into fans like NASCAR does. So you're asking people to give up making their annual income in order to make the ticket prices cheaper. And I don't know what you do. I know in the Charlotte area at one point in time, the SMI worked with the local hotels and actually funneled some money to them to force hotel room prices down. I don't know that they still do that, but I know I was told at one point, I want to say it was 8 or 10 years ago, that it was one of those deals where hotel prices were getting really out of hand. And so SMI met with all of the hotels. You had to be within a certain distance or whatever, but they funneled some of their money back to them in exchange for them dropping the hotel prices some. So I don't know if that's what has to go on in Bristol. I don't know if the state of Tennessee needs to step in and be like, hey, you know, we're looking at losing a major event because you people are charging ridiculous hotel prices. Because, and at the same time, look at the campgrounds. I mean, it ain't that much to camp at Bristol, and the campgrounds were way empty. So there are alternatives, but at the same time, from a convenience standpoint, yeah, we need to work on hotel prices a little bit.
Yeah, because if they lose that race, I mean, like you said, a lot of their annual income from hotel revenue and whatever is driven because of NASCAR. So if they lose that, and, you know, we've both been to Bristol. It's kind of in the middle of nowhere. Yes, it's kind of cool because the town goes over the line, over the Virginia and Tennessee line, but the border. But if they lose that, man, I don't know. If they lose one of the races, and we don't want that because the racing's good. It's been really good the past couple of years. And like we said this past week, great racing. So that'd be a shame for Bristol. One of the, I truly, it's my favorite track on the circuit. So, you know, the more racing, the better on short tracks, yes. But people need to come out, come support it, or else,
absolutely,
or else they're not going to get it.
But I hear all these people whining, you know, that we don't race at Rockingham anymore. All I say is y'all didn't show up. We had the trucks come back to Rockingham. They did 30-something thousand people, sold the place out the first year. Second year, it was 15,000 people. If you don't show up, there's no reason for NASCAR to move dates to your short tracks. So if you're going to scream and holler that you need more short tracks, we got to fill the places out when we have it at short tracks. Martinsville was not sold out. Richmond or Bristol was far from sold out. So see what Richmond looks like this weekend.
I mean, this is a whole other topic, but the sport grew really fast 20 years ago, 15, 20 years ago. So, I mean, when did Bristol go to its current layout of 160,000 stands? Because that's, I mean, that's a lot. It's
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's still, right now, they have more seats than any other track on the schedule.
Yeah.
I mean, Daytona's at 100,000. Charlotte, I think, is now at 89 or 90,000, maybe. Yeah, nobody else is over. Nobody's anywhere close to 100,000, and they got 160,000 seats.
So,
and the place will be packed out for the night race. Don't get me wrong; it'll be
For sure.
May not be sold out, but it'll be packed.
Yeah, they won't sell it out for a while, in my opinion. Now with 160,000, maybe the solution is to cut some of the seats out and make it like into bars or something at the top. I don't know. Yeah. That's just something I came up with.
I would say it was late '90s. I think. 97, 98 might be when they expanded to the max seating capacity they got now.
I mean, it looks great going in. When you walk into the place, it's like, holy shit, this place is massive. You know, it's a half mile, but it's huge.
It's an unreal. It was a coliseum. It really is. Down in there, in the middle of the infield, and you just look up, and it's just straight up all the way around. There's no gap. And they race, and the noise is just brutal in the infield because there's
so loud.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And I wish we had like four more of them, you know, to go to. Although at the same time, I don't. That's one of the things that worries me is like, I love Bristol, but if we had three or four of them, it might not be as cool. Kind of like Salem and Winchester, you know, are both in Indiana. They're both pretty similar looking tracks and they offer very similar racing. You don't want to get too much of a good thing.
Yeah, and also, I know on the, I think it was a Steve Phelps episode, maybe the one before, I can't remember the guest at the time, but Dale Jr. was promoting Bristol. So when you have the most recognizable name in NASCAR kind of promoting, you know Bristol, and no one comes out, it's frustrating. But
yep.
Moving on, we talked, that went in depth more than I thought it was going to go. Something I do want to talk about briefly enough is Darrell Waltrip. A lot of things came out last week. You know, Jenna Fry wrote a piece kind of not bashing him, but saying it's time. And then it was expected that, you know, he's going to make an announcement, which he did. I think it came out on Thursday. And then he had a heartwarming press conference on Friday. I didn't get to see all of it, but I saw highlights. And I mean, you weren't a Darrell Waltrip fan, right? Or were you?
I mean, growing up, no.
Yeah. So, I mean, you saw him race. Probably every race he's ever raced.
I don't know about that.
not calling you old enough.
I saw the good Darrell and the bad Darrell racing.
So, I mean, he's retiring from the sport. He's 72 years, retiring from broadcasting, I should say. at 72 years old. I don't know. My opinion is he was a really good broadcaster for a long period of time, but the fast...
10 or 12 years.
Yeah, yep. And the past 6 or 8 years have kind of gone down, especially with the addition of Jeff Gordon to the booth. It just doesn't seem like the chemistry's there. So I think it's, I don't necessarily think it's the right time. I think the right time was 4 or 5 years ago. But
yep, I agree.
What are your takes on Darrell retiring? Because obviously one of the most recognizable names in the sport history, in a driver that's accomplished so much.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, like you said, I wasn't a big Darrell fan growing up. I appreciated his ability because he was a great driver. But having been around him at media things and listening to him talk off air is when you really appreciate Darrell. Because when he's on air and he's all gung-ho about racing and excited and pumped up and just totally into racing, you get him off air, he is exactly the same.
Right.
He cannot get enough of it. He will stand there and talk with fans until his handlers drag him away because he's got to go do something else. His passion for racing and especially for NASCAR and wanting to see NASCAR succeed is second to none. And that's what I love about him, is because a lot of these guys, you know, once they're off the mic, they don't give a crap, and you don't see them, and they don't really want to spend time with fans, and it's just a job. And to Darrell, it was his passion, and it's his love. But at the same time, and I was talking with some folks this weekend at Auto Fair about it, is announcer Darrell now is Kmart driving Darrell. You had the Western Auto days and the Mountain Dew days and the Budweiser days. That was the first 12 to 13 years of Darrell's announcing. Then you had the Kmart days where he was terrible and just logging laps, and that's kind of where he's at now. And to give Jenna some love, I guess, I didn't think she said anything untoward or hateful to Darrell.
Neither do I.
I think she said what all of us have been saying for 5 years. And I don't understand why she got so much vitriol over it when we've all known that Darrell's skills as an announcer have dwindled or have faded. And at the same time, I'm a Cubs fan. I think most people know that I'm a Cubs fan. I had to listen to Harry Carey for 20-something years, misstating names, quoting stuff wrong. He was Harry, and you loved him because he was Harry. And Darrell's the same way. I don't care if he calls him, you know, Ryan Newhouse. I still love Darrell because it's Darrell, and he loves the sport. But you know, if you want accuracy and professional announcing, it's been time to move on for 4 or 5 years. And if, you know, if Jenna's piece caused him to announce his retirement a couple months before he was really planning on it, you know, I guess I would have rather him be able to go out on his terms and hers, but we knew it was coming. I honestly didn't expect him to be back this year. I thought they were going to announce in January that he was done, but they decided to give him one more year. So he's done amazing things for the sport, both on the track and off. He will always be beloved, and he can come back and announce anytime he wants to. If he ever wants to come down to Myrtle Beach Speedway, we'd love to have him be an announcer for us. And there comes a time, and it's time for Darrell to move on, and we will see who ends up in the booth or if they just let it be Gordon and Joy. And in all honesty, I don't know if it's not time for Mike Joy to go.
I've said that.
I mean, Mike Joy is still one of the best racing announcers in the business, but if you're going to shake up the booth, shake up the whole booth and put all new people in it.
I think they're kind of priming Adam Alexander maybe to take over that role, and he does a really good job with Xfinity, and he has a tough – this is a total different topic, but he has a really difficult job, you know, having to mesh with all these drivers every week, whether this week, you know, Harvick and Bowyer, some weeks Harvick and Keselowski, Harvick and Jones, whoever. I think they might be priming him for the play-by-play spot. But when it comes to Darrell, I also, like you, didn't think anything was – really bad about Jenna's piece. I think the only thing I think is, like you, maybe fans thought it was distasteful because I think a lot of people, and there's been a ton of rumblings around the garage that this is his last year. So yes, like you said, he probably won. He should have got announced when he wanted it to or whatever. And I think it probably forced a little bit, maybe a couple weeks or so. But I mean, it happened in Tennessee, which isn't far from his home in Kentucky. So I don't know. But when it comes to like my thoughts, like I said, I thought he was a good announcer for 10, 12 years. It's probably been 4 or 5 years too long. And when I got into the sport at the end of 2014, you know, obviously then it was ESPN, Yeah, ESPN was covering the sport. So Fox comes in 2015. You know, I cover a few races with Fox on the Fox schedule. Same thing in 16, you know, starting to expand my role 17, 18. I've never seen Darrell Walsh in the garage, ever. Outside of, like, media, you know, obligations, whether it's at in the media center or wherever it may be, like at Daytona's specific areas. But I've never seen him in the garage, and I feel like it's misinforming the fans if you have the wrong information. You're telling them the wrong things. When you got Jeff Gordon, who's fresh out of the car, you know, now it's been, what, 3 years? But he still has a knowledge. He knows these drivers way better than Darrell does. So it's just, I don't know. It's been too long, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you that I don't know that I've seen Darrell in the garage maybe but once or twice in the last decade. But I haven't seen Jeff Gordon in the garage more than once or twice since he retired. It's not like I see, which kind of surprises me. I expect guys in the booth to want to be down there and be talking, and if not to the drivers, maybe more to the crew chiefs. Right. I still feel like if I'm wanting to announce and talk about the car and how the car is doing things, I feel like you get a lot better feedback from crew chiefs than you do from drivers, because drivers do so much with their seat of their pants, and as much as you try to articulate that, you really can't.
Right.
Just because feeling what the car does is what makes them the top drivers that they are, you know, and that's why I like to think I would talk to crew chiefs more. But that's, so I know when I'm announcing local short tracks, I'm down there trying to talk to guys and find out, you know, what's new, what's different, what's going on, and just get a little backstory to fill in when you need to. But at that level, yeah, I would think they would be down in the garage, especially early in the weekend, you know, when their guys are first unloading, because that's when you got a little more time to be around folks. But it's a different world at the Cup level, and you're dealing with egos, and you're dealing with guys that have really big salaries.
Yeah.
And they think that, you know, I'm speaking out of turn here, but they probably think that they know enough that they don't have to. But at the same time, I'm with you. It's disingenuous if you're saying that you're talking to Cruz when you're not talking to Cruz. But again, the other thing, I don't know what goes on in the bus lot.
That's true.
Because there's a lot of talking that goes on in the driver bus lot, and there's crew chiefs in there too. And those announcers often are in that lot with their own RVs. And so there are times when they're down there, you know, after hours or whatever, talking about stuff that we don't hear about. So we may be missing out on that. But I'm with you. In the time that I've been in sport, I was talking the other day about it. I'm working on 14 years of doing this, and it's incredibly rare to see the national booth guys in the media center or in the garage.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't want to compare NBC to Fox at all, but I feel like NBC, like, I see Dale Jr. in the garage quite a bit. I see Steve Letarte and Jeff Burton in the garage quite a bit. And they're kind of new still. And you have Darrell Walsh, who's been there for 20 years now. And he's just not, I've never seen him in the garage. And granted, like I said, I've only been covering the sport full-time since 2015. So it's 5 years, the back half of his career, obviously. So I'm probably the wrong person to talk to about it, honestly. But I don't know, I can only give my opinion, and I did. So
that's why we're here.
Yeah, of course. Now, Neff, we're going to Richmond this weekend. We got the Cup and Xfinity race. Last year, Christopher Bell swept the Xfinity races. Kyle Busch swept the Cup races. Is that happening this weekend? Who you got?
I'm going with Allgaier on the.
He's got to win.
God, I felt so awful for him. I mean, he won both stages, although the first stage was a gift.
Yeah, right. On the final lap.
You know, I felt really bad for the spotter. I'm sure he got
on Reddick
yelled at a little bit. Although I know he didn't get yelled at too bad, because I'm friends with the crew chief on their car, and he doesn't yell at anybody. So, yeah, I think Reddick's going to give him a run, but I'm going to go with Allgaier in the Xfinity side of stuff. Cup side, I'm sorry. I know it's a cheap way out, but I'm taking Busch. I mean, he's just he's good at Richmond. He's good at all short tracks. He's on a roll this year. We'll keep our fingers crossed that he spins on lap one or two and goes to the back because that seems to be his best time for winning races. But he's a stud.
He is indeed a stud. As far as Xfinity, I'm taking Bell. In the last, we're going way out on limbs here. In the last four short track races, he's got three wins and a second. And then he's also got a couple wins at Phoenix, which, depending on what you consider a short track, it's a mile.
I call it a short track, yeah. That's me.
And so he won the fall race there, obviously, to get the championship four. So I got Bell. And as far as the cup race, if you know, I don't believe, and I asked this driver last year after he lost another race at this track, if he believes that a track owed you one, and he says no. But if there was one, this one would. I'm going Martin Truex Jr., man. This guy, in the last five races at Richmond, has led the most laps in four of them and has led over 121 laps in all four of those races. So, I mean, last year he led 121 and 163. In the fall 2017 race, he led 198. In the fall 2016 race, 193. And he's never won on a short track. So I think that comes to a close this weekend at Richmond. It's kind of destined to happen. It almost, he leads all these laps and then, you know, has an average finish of like eighth or ninth because he has finished, he had wrecked out in the fall 2017 race, finished 20th on the last lap. So, and they need a win. I feel like they need to prove now, I mean, we talked about it earlier, they've been off this year a little bit. They need to prove that, you know, nothing's wrong. They're perfectly fine. So.
Yeah. I agree with you on that. I think, You could rectify a lot of ills with one broad brushstroke this weekend for them. Get the short track win out of the way, get some speed back, show them that you haven't lost it or that you're getting it back. Yeah, it would be a big weekend for that 19 team for sure if they were able to secure a win.
Yeah, indeed. You got any final thoughts before we sign off?
Yeah, we didn't even talk about the Xfinity race. We got to talk about that.
That was a good race.
I mean, Christopher Bell was a bag of hammers for the first half of that race. He was awful. And all of a sudden, they came in and made an adjustment, and it was like they hooked up the NOS bottle. That thing took off and was unbelievable. And unfortunately for Allgaier, you know, he had a failure that cost him. But it was a great race in general, but I could not believe one adjustment on Bell's car made that much difference. It was insane how much faster he was after, I think it was the second or third pit stop they made an adjustment. That car just took off.
Yeah. He was really loose the first like two thirds of that race. And then maybe when stage three began, that's when it started to come in. But yeah, I think he would have gotten by Allgaier, even if Allgaier didn't have his, I think it was a right front hub that kind of broke or whatever. Had that not happened, I still think he would have got by because he was really, really fast. But there's a good battle there for a while between those two, Cole Custer, Tyler Reddick, all for the lead. And
yeah,
I mean, those are probably the top four drivers in Xfinity. I never thought I'd say this, but you could throw Michael and Ed in there because he's got a really good average finish this year. And he just kind of,
he does.
At 7.6, and he's got a couple top fives and five top tens. Last year, only had three the whole year. So, I mean, there's him, there's Chase Briscoe that's starting to come around, three straight top fives. The Xfinity series, I mean, I'm the beat writer, so I'm going to put it over as it is, but I'm a big fan. And yes, it might be down in, not in star power, but in numbers, because we lost two Roush cars. We lost two full-time RCR cars, Chip Ganassi, but it's pretty good. And you got all these, now you got teams like DGM Racing and Bobby Dotter's team starting to get, you know, top 15, top 20 finishes. That's big for those teams.
Absolutely.
So I'm, you know, go Xfinity.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think the racing's been outstanding. I think you've seen some teams, like you said, that don't have the opportunity to show as much, that are showing out a little more now that the overall field of regulars was cut down a little bit. And I honestly don't think it's hurt the product. I think the product's still been good. And, you know, you have the constant argument about the Cup guys getting in there. But it was – I thought the racing was great this weekend. And I, much as we don't want to admit it, Christopher Bell is still head and shoulders above everybody, I think, on a talent level in the Xfinity Series. I know we got a lot of dudes that are good, but Christopher Bell is just at a whole different level.
Yeah, I totally agree about Bell. But speaking of the Xfinity Series, why don't we throw it to my conversation with Harrison Burton. All right, Harrison, you made your Xfinity Series debut this past weekend at Bristol. You started 5th, finished 10th. Take us through your weekend as a whole.
Well, it was a fun weekend. It was up and down for sure. We had good qualifying effort, so that made our weekend a little bit easier, and the car was really good. So it was definitely a fun experience. We had early contact with the 00, and we got in the wall and eventually cut a tire in stage 3, but rebounded and ended up finishing 10th. So that was good that we were able to rebound from that. Cut tire and come back and still finish top 10 was good. But, that result isn't quite what we wanted, but that's okay. And I learned a lot and had a lot of fun doing it. So we can move on to the next ones and be happy.
Was that was your first time in an Xfinity car ever, right? Like you never had practiced one?
Yeah, no, I stepped in the car for the first time the day before the race for practice. So it was a quick learning curve to make for sure, but luckily I had experience at Bristol on the racetrack, so that made my job a little bit easier.
Yeah, and I wanted to bring up you and Cole making contact. Looked like he put you in the wall, and you got a flat tire, like you said, late in the race. How bad did cutting that tire in stage 3 affect the way the car handled, the remaining of the race?
It definitely didn't help it, the contact was just a racing thing at Bristol, it happened so quick there. And I couldn't have reaction time quick enough to back out of it. He didn't, think I was there. So it was definitely just a racing thing that happened. And that's something that you kind of expect at Bristol when you race there. So, honestly, it definitely didn't help it. We had some pieces and parts that were bent that made it a little bit tighter and kind of, hurt us a little bit, but not too bad. And it was obviously still good enough to finish in the top 10 in the Xfinity Series. So it's not too bad, right?
Yeah. And as you mentioned, you had track experience at Bristol, whether it be in K&N trucks. I know you got a K&N race win there in the past. But it's last great Coliseum. Bristol's tough. So why was this the debut race? Why did you have to choose Bristol, or was there other options?
Bristol is... it's probably one of my favorite racetracks, really? Honestly. So, I figured there was not a better place I could have picked to do it. I had a lot of fun doing it. That's kind of why I race. I race because I love it. And I race because the opportunity I have to do this is a once-in-a-lifetime one. So I might as well go in with a bang and try and figure it out at one of the hardest racetracks. So I think that there wasn't a whole lot of thought into it other than it was just one of my favorite racetracks, and I wanted to run it. And that was my first one that Kyle or Jeffrey wasn't in. So it worked out pretty good for me. I got to drive one of my favorite racetracks in the Xfinity Series. So that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, and who did you lean on for advice going up to the green flag?
I have a lot of options. I work for Kyle Busch. I drive in the his truck full-time, which is a really cool experience. You get to learn from the dude that is winning everything right now. That's a good person to listen to for sure. So, for me, that was a guy that I talked to some. I talked to obviously my dad, Jeff Burton, has had success there and has had good races against Kyle Busch there and almost won. I told him he should have bumped Kyle out of the way for that one, but but no. So I got to lean on my dad some, and also I have a. Links with Kevin Harvick through Kevin Harvick KHI, which is his management company that helps me with that side of the business and the business side of racing. So I have contacts with all kinds of Cup drivers just through being around the garage, and those are the three that I normally lean on.
Yeah, and of course your dad obviously won a bunch of Xfinity Series races in his day, and he's always been there with you for your career. But how can and not just him, but like Kyle or Kevin or whoever, how can they actually help prepare you? Because ultimately it's up to you, right? I mean, to do the job.
Yeah, for sure. And that's what's interesting is a lot of times you get three different opinions from three different guys, and then it's like, okay, that's what I do. so you listen to everything that they say, right, and you take it into account, and then you just got to go try it. You got to go you do your own homework, you prepare, you watch race film, you watch, you know, you do your stuff on the simulator, you go to the racetrack and feel prepared, and you make your first run, and then you can kind of start playing with things and try and make the car and yourself better. As a rookie, you can focus. It's easy to get too focused on one or the other, either too focused on yourself and you're not focusing on working on the car enough, or too focused on the car and not working on yourself enough. So that's a hard balance you have to do as a rookie. So for me, that was kind of the hardest thing about it was kind of working on the car and me at the same time and trying to figure out which is, you know, causing me to need an extra tenth of a second. You know, it's very small increments in this sport. So that was the toughest part. But other than that, I think the biggest thing is just doing your homework before you get there and going there with a plan.
Yeah, and I've asked the same question to other drivers on this podcast the past couple of weeks, like of Ryan Truex or Jeb Burton. But how challenging is it to fit in with teammates and kind of give your input when maybe you haven't raced with them in the past and definitely haven't raced in the series or the team? So how challenging is it, I guess, for them to trust your input, like a Brandon Jones and Christopher Bell this past weekend?
Well, luckily for me, I've gotten to race against both of them and with both of them before.
Correct.
I raced with Christopher Bell through KBM, and he was my teammate there when I was part-time. And he went on to win the championship that year, so we got to know each other through that. It was cool to be around him when he won that championship. And then Brandon Jones and I actually drove. We split an ARCA car ride last year in the number 12, which was it used to be MBM Motorsports. They're not racing this year, but me and him split that car, and he would run some races and I would run others. And so we kind of got to learn each other through that and hang out a little bit more and became pretty good friends. So I had a... you know, an easy in with those guys, which is good. I had already raced with them and worked with them in the past, so everything just felt really natural and nothing was too out of the ordinary.
For sure. Now, I got to ask, obviously you're running the 18 car for a total of 8 races this year. It's already won 3 times, though, with Kyle, so, you know, how much pressure is there to perform? Obviously, Kyle's the all-time wins leader in the Xfinity Series, but how much pressure are you putting yourself to perform in arguably the best car in the series?
For sure, yeah, and that's my job, right? As a driver, I have to go and perform and contend for wins and cars that are capable of winning, and that's what I want to do. All the pressure that's on me is normally from myself, and I'm the biggest critic of myself as well. So I was joking with the guys at the shop that the 3 win stickers that are on that car were the 3 easiest I've ever had on a car that I drove. I just sent a text and said, good job after, right? So I definitely want to earn a win sticker that's my own. And hopefully we'll be in a position later in this year to do that. So there's that pressure to perform always, and especially when you're in a car that is proven good enough to win with a guy like Kyle Busch in it. And Jeffrey Earnhardt has been running really good in it as well. So it was a confidence booster for me to run good this past weekend and contend for top 5 in the early going there and you know, show that I had speed. So hopefully we can build off that and end up with adding another win sticker on there.
Yeah, and I'm curious, what are you hoping to get out of this experience in the Xfinity Series with Gibbs? Like, are there goals or expectations that you're putting on yourself or that, you know, they've kind of put on you? Because you're brand new to this series.
Yeah, and that's a hard thing, right? Is how do you put a goal on something that you've never done before? And how do you assess that? And I think the biggest thing is just to make me a better race car driver and make me more prepared for the future. You know, and have fun while doing those 2 things. So for me, the biggest thing that I can do is just soak everything in like a sponge and learn everything that I can while I'm there, because you never know when you're going to have an opportunity like that again. So you have to take it all in and become the best driver that you can while you have great people like that around you, and then hopefully the future you'll be more prepared from that. So I think that I can take what I learned in the Xfinity Series and bring it back to my full-time truck deal with Kyle Busch Motorsports and be a better truck driver because of it and have more confidence when I go to the racetrack that that I can do this and I belong there for sure.
Yeah, I would say that definitely probably doesn't hurt. But it seems like from an outside perspective anyway, you've won right off the bat in pretty much everything you've ever been in, excluding trucks, but you're still, I mean, you're new to that series too, primarily being a rookie this year. But what would you consider successful in this, you know, limited 8-race ride in the 18 car?
Well, it's so hard to win one of these races. Everything has to go right. But for me, my goal is to contend for wins. So to be in the mix and to be a guy that people are, you know that can win at any given time, I think is a really big thing for me to be a competitor, right? My job as a race car driver is to win races and perform well. So, you know, you're not going to win them all. And you have to go into that knowing that. And it's not unheard of for the best drivers in the world to go on 8 races without winning a race, right? So I only have 8 races. So you never know if you're going to win or not. And you never know if everything's going to work out perfectly for you in those 8 races. But you have to control what you can control. And hopefully that means that I'll do a good enough job to put ourselves in position to win. And then after that, we'll just see what happens. So I'm not going to put a position number or a win number on it. I just think that as long as I put ourselves in position to do it and come out with either a great finish or a win, then you know, we can have a lay our heads down at night and be happy about that for sure.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'd be remiss, though, if I didn't ask you a little bit about the truck series. We're 5 races in this year. Overall, how would you assess the season so far?
Well, it's been kind of like our Bristol race. It's been up and down. You know, we started and we had a really fast truck at Daytona and had an opportunity to win there. And me and my teammate, Todd Gilliland, were getting really aggressive and got too aggressive and we both wrecked. Which is never good when you wreck with your teammates. So Kyle wasn't pleased about that one. So, no, but you know, that was a race that we, you know, you never know what could happen. We could have won that race if we had not had a wreck. Then you go to Atlanta and run second or third all day, and then mess up on the last restart and finish 8th. You know, the top in Atlanta is really hard to work, but I still could have done a better job, you know, on that restart and got a better launch. But, you know, I didn't, and I learned from that. We take that 8th place finish, and then we moved to Vegas and had a 5th place finish, which is, you know, about where we deserve to run there, I felt like. I felt like we ran about 5th all weekend. That's about where our truck was, and we finished there, so that was good. Martinsville, we struggled, honestly. We struggled in Martinsville and finished 11th. So, you know, it's definitely been up and down. And the races that we could have won or contended for a win, like Atlanta, we just didn't capitalize on it yet. So, you know, we just got to move on and not take that too heart and just realize that we had the speed to do it and we had the potential to do it. It just didn't work out and hopefully get a little bit better and see me in victory lane soon.
Yeah, and this might be a weird question, but obviously you're still going to high school, so has going up, you know, running the full schedule now in the truck series, going up the proverbial ladder, so to speak, has that been more challenging than you thought it might be?
The balance of everything has been very challenging, especially recently. I'm trying to graduate high school and try and wrap up that, you know, portion of my life, and there's a lot of pressures that come with that, and I'm trying to move up this career path that I have and this awesome opportunity that I have. And that's a lot of pressure. And then I have, you know, just any normal high school social pressures that kids go through. And so I have a lot going on right now. And yeah, it's been tough. And I think that's a good thing though, because I think at the end of the day, I'll be stronger from it and be a better person from it. And hopefully be a better race car driver from it. So, I've enjoyed it. I've had some moments where I'm like, how am I going to do all this? And it's been tough, but, you know, we're making it through and hopefully we'll, get done with high school with grades that my mom will be happy enough with. And then I can focus on this racing deal and do some online college stuff as well. So I'll stay busy, but, you know, a little bit less busy once I'm done.
Yeah. And you brought up a key word there in balance, between high school, ARCA, trucks, Xfinity, how are you balancing not just the school aspect, but, you know, stepping into these race cars or trucks, you know, because I'm assuming they drive quite a bit different. I've never driven a car, race car or anything, so I'm assuming they drive a little bit different. So how can you, like, kind of keep balance between the different series?
Yeah, it's tough, you know, and you have all this going on, and you're like, I don't know, you have a lot of people that are relying on you, right? These people, their job is to make a race car go fast, so if you don't perform well enough to make that race car go fast, then you're letting them down. So you have a lot of people that depend on you, and you have to do your homework and prove that to them that you're willing to work and learn and get better. I think that's the biggest thing is just having that mindset is the biggest thing that's helped me recently is just going to work and putting your head down, and even though it might suck in the moment that you know all your buddies are out hanging out, but you're going to be better off because you've been working your butt off and trying to be a better race car driver than you would be just slacking off and stuff. So that's the biggest thing that has helped me is just being in the mindset of always trying to improve and always trying to get better, and then hopefully the rest will take care of itself from there.
Got it. Now I'll get you out of here on this one, Harrison. I'm thinking back to you mentioned earlier how Kyle wasn't happy when you and Todd got into one another. You might have been joking, maybe not. And I'm only saying that because I think it was Atlanta, and I think it was after Kyle won the truck race where he said Todd's kind of racing for his career. How hard is Kyle on his drivers?
So Kyle is hard on everyone in the best way possible. He expects the best from you because quite honestly, he gave you the opportunity to drive his trucks because he thinks you're capable of it. So when you are not performing, and this is true for both me and Todd, we haven't won yet, and we both think that we should have won by now, and we're both kind of putting the pressure on ourselves. You know, Kyle is tough on us, and it helps us, though. It definitely helps me. I'll speak for myself more than I will for Todd, obviously. That it helps me be a better race car driver when there's someone saying, look, you got to do this and this, and this is, you know, your shot, this is your career, and he's right. You know, this is a really hard sport to get into, and you have to make a splash when you get into it, and you know, I think that's something that is very real, is a possibility that if you don't put the work in and it doesn't shake out for you, then you could lose your seat. So you know, that's true for anyone in this garage, whether you're, you know, a past champion and in the Cup Series, or you're just an up and coming guy. You know, it's no one's stable. It's not a very stable career path for sure. You have to perform every weekend and do your best every weekend. So, it's a lot of pressure, but I think that it's making us better. And I think that me and Todd are both learning from dealing with that pressure, and me and our relationship with Kyle is a good one because of that. He expects us to be the best because he thinks we can be the best and he thinks we can win. So he's hard, but I think it's a good thing for us, and we'll be learning from it and be better from it.
Well, cool, Harrison. Definitely appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule. A good run in the Xfinity Series at Bristol, and we'll see you in Dover in the Truck Series.
Yeah, for sure. Sounds good. I appreciate it.
All right, y'all. I gotta be honest with you. I think that was the first time I've interviewed Harrison Burton, and I gotta be honest, I was really impressed by his humbleness, and as we've seen, what he can do in a race car. And he's just 18 years old and still in high school. That's truly unbelievable. I really wouldn't be surprised if he won one of the remaining 7 races for Joe Gibbs Racing this year in the Xfinity Series. And who knows, maybe he'll get that truck title too, even though right now he's sitting just outside the top 8. That's it for this week's podcast. Make sure to tune in next week, and until then, we out.